Donald Trump announced it just the other day. We paused Iranian strikes as negotiations resume. But then you pivot over and you read what the Iranian foreign minister said just yesterday, that no, we're not negotiating with them. We have no interest in negotiating with the United States, which he compared to a mafia gang that adheres to no rules or laws. So I get the impression, and here's kind of where I wanted to start. They overthrew the Shah. It was a Western-esque country. Women had rights. They could drive. They could get jobs. I had a woman used to cut my hair that came from Iran post-revolution. She got out because she saw what was happening there. They don't like Western anything. They're not interested in adopting or embracing or working peacefully with a bunch of satanic, in their mind, Western countries who would undermine their faith and their values, which are completely inconsistent with Western values. I get the impression they don't want to do anything with us. Don't keep inviting us to play nicely in your sandbox. We don't want to have anything to do with your sandbox.
I think it's a little more complicated than that, and we've helped complicate it some of it, because it's not just that we don't like their system of government or vice versa. It's that we have supported, we've started two wars with them in a span of 8 months, and we assassinated their senior leader. We assassinated people in their presidential inauguration, et cetera. Their scientists, we killed people by hitting their apartment buildings and taking out their entire families along with them, et cetera. So there's a lot of reason for animosity for them not to want us. However, even with all of that said, there still has been a distinct, I don't know if we would call them moderates or a Western-leaning element within Iran, but it's more like pragmatists. They're saying, listen, this is the world that we have, whether we like it or not. America is the powerful country. Israel is a powerful country. We've got to learn to live along with them somehow, even if we hate them. And then there's the other side. There's the, you know, what we call the hardliners, which are the ones that said there's no point in talking to them. All they'll do is, you know, according to them, all they'll do is promise things and then they'll not keep it, and to our harm. So let's just keep going with the war, et cetera. So what they're doing right now, we talked about Foreign Minister Araghchi, at the state level, at the direct level, they are not talking with us. That is accurate. But at the Omani and Qatari moderator level, there are still good talks going back and forth, because for Iran, if they can get back to a situation to the MOU, all the terms that go along with it, and that means all of them, they're still willing to discuss if, and this is the huge issue here, if they can get some things up front that they didn't get before, because they don't have any trust in us. And this whole issue about the Strait of Hormuz is probably point number one, well, along with the literal point number one about Lebanon, more on that in a minute, I guess. Yeah. But the real issue was the Strait of Hormuz. And the only thing in paragraph five is that Iran would administer the strait for 60 days without a toll. And then Iran and Oman would do the figure out what was going to happen after that. We had no role in it. But then 4 days in, we said, here's a new southern corridor in the Omani waters, and we're going to control that. And of course, that led to the confusion and the dispute. Iran fired on some of the ships that didn't do what they said. We fired on Iran, and you know what happened after that. And so now then we've got to try to get back to that. And U.S. is thinking, and maybe you want to go here too, with Benjamin Netanyahu showing up today. He wants to go back to full-scale war and finish the job, as Jack Keane and several others say. But our generals are telling, General Kane in particular, we don't have the missiles to go back to a full-scale war, or we're going to run out. So we're in a real big bind, I'll just tell you.
Well, and that, I'm glad you brought that up, because it was an interesting journal piece, an op-ed piece from the editorial board, the White House missiles shortage excuse. A journal expressing, they were actually, the journal I will describe as pissed off that someone actually said that out loud, that we are short on missiles. Like, there was some sort of valuable state secret that's been revealed to the world, and the Iranians now know it. Is it a true statement from your intel and your resources that we've got a problem with munitions?
I can tell you from every source I have that is absolutely, and I'm talking at the highest level in the White House, that is absolutely true. And you don't even have to have the White House. You don't have to have any sources there. The open source information we have is self-evident. For example, all you've got to do is go back, and a friend of mine has done this analysis, all you got to do is go back to when we started allocating money for different kinds of missile systems going back many, many years. And you see how much the unit cost is, how many were made, and then you see how many we've expended, and you're like, oh, snap, we've used a bunch of them, a huge percentage of them. And listen, there's a reason why we stopped after 40 days. It's not because we wanted to give space to negotiations. It was because we can see it wasn't running. It wasn't working. We could not force compliance from Iran. We could not take control of the Strait of Hormuz with the missiles. And if we kept going, we would just run out and still fail. That's where we still are today.
Well, that's a troubling and disturbing reality, considering all the challenges we currently and may face down the road. So what of statements, what of Donald Trump's statement saying, listen, yeah, we're negotiating, we're trying to negotiate, otherwise we're ready to go back to strong military action. You can't go back to strong military action unless you have the weapons to back it up.
That's true. And I'm again told from somebody who has quite high access, he is still thinking about it. And he's told that it will not work, just like they told him at the end of the 40 days, or why it ended at 40 days, because it wouldn't work. There's nothing has changed, because you can't manufacture these missiles in anything less than years. And I'm talking individual missiles. They basically, you may not know this, but almost all of our advanced missiles are handmade. It's not like a factory where you have cars going down and they keep putting this same piece on an assembly line. These almost have to all be made handmade. So that's why it takes 2 to 5 years for a missile to be done, along with a lot of other reasons. So we haven't added any to our inventory since then, other than a handful here and there. And to go back, but here's the key thing. Even if you could, those missiles don't penetrate granite mountains. And those missile cities are the number one asset that Iran has. We just can't blow up. All these things we did in this 13-day mini strike that we did, you know, for a while, we blew up a bunch of stuff on the surface, and it hurt. I've done an analysis of that, too. And it did hurt them, took out radars, took out the control systems for maritime traffic, killed a number of military personnel, et cetera. But that does nothing to the thing that they use to control the strait. It just didn't help at all, and it just pushes down the road, and the strait is still mainly closed, and that's harming our economy.
Yeah, and that seems to me, I don't know if this was a surprising development, but if you stop and look at things right now, at least based upon my recollection of history, and you're going to be better at this than me, Iran didn't have control of the Strait of Hormuz before we started this campaign. It was considered international waters. Ships were free to flow back and forth. The global economy wasn't interrupted on a regular basis because the Iranians were blowing up boats. They seem to have gained an upper hand that perhaps just they became aware of in this bombing campaign, or exercised an option that they otherwise hadn't done before, which is shutting down the Strait of Hormuz. Where are we on that?
That's the key issue. They everyone had always known that was a possibility. It's been talked about for literally decades that they could do this, but Iran would never take that step by themselves, because then that would bring international condemnation, and they knew that would prompt a war against them that they couldn't win, but that it would cause them significant damage. So they would only do that when it was forced on them, and that's the only leverage they had left, and then they had no reason not to. So they had a plan to do this all along. And we had a plan to try and diminish it, but because of these missile cities that neutralized all of the plans we had done in the decades prior, because now we can't reach them. And by the way, there's another issue here. When you're talking about running out of Tomahawk cruise missiles and JASSM long-range cruise missiles, especially our two premier types of weapons, if you run out of those, or if you get so few you can't risk getting into your Pacific or your European war stocks, which is now a big risk, they do have other things like JDAMs and small diameter bombs and a couple of other categories of things. But the problem with those is they have to be air launched, and the ranges are a lot shorter, which means now that you have to use a lot more aircraft to get closer into the target, and you will wear them out. And by the way, they're not going to be any more effective at that target set than these would. So even though we may have plenty of JDAMs and SDBs, we don't have the airframes and the pilots that we would wear them out and still not succeed. That's what everybody needs to understand.
Well, can any of the other Middle Eastern countries that are now the regular subject of the attacks by the Iranians, we blow something blow something up in Iran, they immediately attack, you know, Kuwait or other oil producing countries there. Some of them, I think, have been starting to launch their own retaliatory strikes, but do they have effective enough militaries or effective enough quantities of arms that they could, and I've passed this theory past you in the past, and you've rejected it as a concept, that finally they say, no mas, this is it, we've got to do something about Iran, let's all collectively get together and start beating up on Iran together, and maybe we can accomplish something along those lines. Daniel?
But they'd love to say no mas, like on the second or third day of the war, if they could have, but they don't, because they have basically farmed out their security to the United States. That's what all these bases were supposed to do, was supposed to basically be our protection of them. And that's, you know, all the quid pro quos and the economic deals they did, et cetera, gave us access and all that. But this is the cost that they themselves have basically a National Guard top and a very weak one at that. I mean, you're right. I think UAE and I want to say it was Kuwait had some token strikes, but they're nothing. I mean, they're literally nothing, because they don't have the capability we do. And if we couldn't do it, they sure can't. Saudi Arabia tried for almost a decade to bring the Houthis under control, and just, you know, right off their coast. They never succeeded there either, just with the Houthis. So they just don't have the military capacity, is the bottom line.
Can a parallel be drawn between that situation and NATO countries, who also didn't bother keeping their military up and arming themselves while relying upon the United States to act as the stabilizing force there? Is that kind of a parallel?
It's not quite as bad in Europe, but categorically it is very, very similar. There's no question about it. It's not just a matter of how much GDP they spent. Like Germany was below 1% for so many years up until very recently. But nobody was, ever since the end of the Cold War, everybody went way down, because they're like, hey man, USA, all the way, you guys got it. And so they spent money on their own domestic stuff and you know, spent the bare minimum on their national security, so that we would, and we did, up until Trump came into office anyway.
Shouldering the burden. Oh, look at our national debt, Daniel. Anyway, real quick here, I have to pivot over. After I saw this article, I got to ask you about the situation with Russia and Ukraine. North Korea deploying 30,000 troops to Russia to help fight this conflict. I know we've read articles and heard reports of North Korean soldiers helping the Russians out. Is this a reflection of the limited number of soldiers Russia has left? Is this just relying on the sacrificial lambs that the North Koreans are now sending over to fight the battle on their behalf? Where are we with that one, Daniel Davis?
Yeah, it's definitely not a problem with Russian soldiers. As a matter of fact, Putin himself has indicated that this September, so coming up soon, they may mobilize another 500,000 soldiers on top of everything they have, and they have somewhere around 1.5 million active at the moment. So there's no shortage of troops. But what that does imply is that Russia is making serious considerations to significantly ramping up this war and possibly having an offensive in one of the weak points on the Eastern Front that the Ukraine side, even with drones, can't overcome, and they may do it with mass. So I think that is more an indication that Russia is going to take, you know, whatever allies they can get, because they're going to make a big push. And I think that there's a real risk of that.
I was hoping we can make better news out of that deployment of North Korean soldiers to the Russians. Sadly, you see, there's that dose of cold water reality from Daniel Davis.